Welcome you to our official daily press conference, meet the plenary speaker as well as the closing press conference. Good morning. This morning we've had very lively discussions on the plenary, and I hope we'll be able to get even more. As you are aware, the purpose of this conference is to give a wider audience to people to enjoy the benefits of the plenary. Our first plenary speakers, there were two, from today spoke about HIV and incarceration, prisons and detention. Dimitros Shereb is a director of the Department of Communications, Policy and Advocacy at the All-Ukrainian Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS. He has been HIV positive for 14 years and was incarcerated in 1992 to 2001. While in prison, Mr. Shereb studied philosophy and taught himself English. Following his release, he became a volunteer to the harm reduction project Stupen in Chernihiv, and in 2005, he was elected to the Coordination Council of all the Ukrainian network of people living with HIV. Dr. Manfred Nowak is a professor of international human rights protection at the University of Vienna and the director of the Ludwig Boltzmann Institute of Human Rights. He is one of the most significant scholars and experts in the international human rights field. As a researcher and a practitioner, he has authored numerous books and articles. He received the UNESCO Prize for the Teaching of Human Rights. So we'll start with Dimitro.
Do you hear me? Probably those who speak English would need their headsets. Should I wait then a little bit? To be brief, and to repeat what I have already told during the plenary, so I had one main idea. The human rights in the prisons and in detention are not just violated. They're simply being ignored by the authorities. And so that is why all the conditions are created to push the people out of life. So that is why the prison conditions in Ukraine, not just a violation of human rights. This is a crime, a direct crime against the right to live. So that is why we do everything depending on us, that the people in Ukrainian prisons would get the most basic things, like HIV treatment, diagnostics. Of course, this work is not that easy, but the non-governmental sector is doing its best to protect the rights of those incarcerated. At the present moment, we have only started the dialogue between the HIV positive in Ukrainian prisons and in the of the authorities of the prisons. So we hope that in future, when someone is put to prison, only his freedom is taken away, but not the right to life, to sleep, to have a normal life, to continue to live. Members of our organization know personally from their own experience how it is to be put to prison only because they were drug users. That was their only crime. We understand that these measures don't help in stopping the drug use in Ukraine. It only supports the spread of the epidemic. This is a very short-sighted policy, and those tens of thousands of people who should have continued to live, they died. So that was the main message of my talk during the plenary meeting. Recently, the Ukrainian government have made a decision to relocate our leading HIV clinic, which has unique possibilities. It is in the very center of Kyiv, and its premises would be given to a hotel. We're appalled by this decision because about 8,000 of people throughout whole Ukraine would get assistance in this clinic. This clinic was really unique because it had excellent intense therapy possibilities and excellent equipment, and they could have stayed there for longer times. So that is why we living with HIV, we are very much worried what is going to happen with us later on, whether this building is going to be pulled down and a new hotel for the tourists would be built. We don't mind to have more tourists in our country, but we would like the tourists to like our country, not because we have nice hotels, but because the HIV epidemic and TB epidemic would be stopped in our country. Thank you.
Told you his experience in a Ukrainian prison, but this is no exception whatsoever. I'm not just an academic, I'm United Nations Special Rapporteur on torture and other forms of ill treatment. And I've visited during the last 6 years many countries and many prisons, police stations, psychiatric hospitals, and other places where people are deprived of liberty in all regions of the world. And there is a real global prison crisis. You could not imagine how bad the conditions of detention all around the world, with very few exceptions, actually are. Most people have not even a bed. They're sleeping on the floor. There's no access to food, no access to water, no access to health care. There is no empathy for persons behind bars. As soon as you are behind bars, society is not any more interested in how you are treated. 60% of all countries, according to their own official statistics, have overcrowding in prisons, sometimes 3-4 times as many as the capacity, the maximum capacity. That means 3 or 4 prisoners have to fight for a place on the concrete floor to sleep or share a bed or have to fight for everything, the basic needs that they are entitled to. And as you have said, they are deprived of liberty but not of human rights. They are entitled to all other human rights. Reality looks totally different. And that also means that HIV prevalence in prisons is by far higher in most countries of the world than outside prisons. To give you just a few examples, Ukraine, you have a general countrywide prevalence between 1.2 and 2%. In prisons, it's 15 to 30%, so more than 10 times as much. In South Africa, of course, in general, you have 18% HIV prevalence. In prisons, up to 41%. Indonesia, only 0.2%, but in prisons, up to 21%. are HIV positive. There are about 10 million prisoners on average every day around the world, but there are also 30 million persons who enter and leave prisons every year in the world. So it means it's not just a prison health problem, it's a public health problem, because many persons who enter prisons and then are infected with HIV leave the prison again and constitute, of course, a risk for the community at large. Now, what are the main reasons? Of course, it is injecting drug use, it is sex, there are certain other reasons like tattooing. The main message I want to send is we know from medical and other scientific evidence what needs to be done. And we have very good examples in Spain, for instance, that in Spain in 1988, about 50% of all prisoners in Madrid were HIV positive. And today we are down to 7%. Why? Because Spain introduced the distribution of condoms very early. Secondly, in 1996 or 7, they started with needles and syringe programs and again people who inject drugs were one of the main reasons for the spread of HIV in prison. And they also started with a methadone maintenance program. And you can clearly see how year by year the number of prisoners who are HIV positive decreased. So the point is we know what needs to be done, but in reality there's a lack of political will. We have only 11 countries in the whole world that use needle and exchange programs, needle and syringe exchange programs, mostly in Europe, Central Asia. We have only 40 countries who have methadone or other opium substitute programs. It's very much, politics are dominated very much by moralistic attitudes of criminalizing sex work, criminalizing homosexual activity, etc., and that is contributing to the problem, and I just call upon all states in the world to take the medical evidence seriously and to do whatever they can in order to prevent the spread of HIV in prisons and also provide prisoners with the same kind of care and support, antiretroviral treatment and other forms than anybody else, because they are human beings with the same human rights also to health than everybody else. Thank you.
Thank you, Dimitro and Manfred. Now, our second plenary speaker is Dr. Liz Guerra. She's the CEO of the Hospice Palliative Care Association of South Africa and a senior lecturer at the University of Cape Town, where she heads the palliative care unit within the School of Public Health and Family Medicine. In 2007, Dr. Guerra received the South African Medical Association's Gender Award for Human Rights in Health and the South African Institute of Healthcare Managers Leadership in Health System. She's going to summarize her presentation in 2 to 3 minutes.
Thank you. My presentation was looking at the importance of care and support, which is one of the three pillars for universal access, but it's the one that gets the least attention, and in fact there's kind of cutting of funding to care and support very clearly because there are very strong priorities for prevention and treatment. However, prevention, access to treatment, and adherence to treatment happen in the community. And if we don't have community care and support, the prevention messages get lost and the adherence and even access to treatment is less than it should be. So we do support that prevention messages and treatment, access to treatment are critical, but there needs to be integration of all three services, because without the care and support, the person living with HIV continues to suffer in his or her home without the support services, because adequate care and support can't be given with a once-a-month treatment, a once-a-month visit to the clinic. And we feel that it's really important that palliative care is integrated into the care and support programs, not thinking of palliative care as terminal care in care of the dying, because it has become a really important method to assist in the restoration to health of people living with HIV through that respectful care and support that happens in the person's home. And so we also need to value the care work that is done often by women, some of them young girls, some of them the grannies, the older people, whose work is not is sometimes not remunerated at all, and who are doing this stressful, responsible work without the recognition. And these women's voices need to be heard, and we need to have strong caregiver policies in our health policies across the world.
Thank you, Liz. Our final speaker is Dr. David Thomas, whose plenary presentation was entitled Hepatitis C, Cure and Control Right Now. Dr. Thomas is a chief of infectious diseases at the Stanhope Burne-Jones Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He oversees clinical research projects focused on understanding the natural history and the pathogenesis of hepatitis C virus infection. Dr. Thomas is also the principal investigator on numerous National Institutes of Health grants, the author and co-author of over 150 peer-reviewed publications, and holds an U.S. patent. David.
Thanks a lot, Ellie. Yeah, I had a simple message this morning. I'm talking about hepatitis C, which, like tuberculosis, is another infection that disproportionately affects individuals who are living with HIV. I said that hepatitis C was an important problem. In fact, it's important because roughly one out of three HIV-infected persons in Europe, the United States, and Australia has hepatitis C. I said it was also important because HIV makes all of the consequences of hepatitis C worse. So it's become, in some places, actually the leading cause of death. Heart doesn't do anything, doesn't do enough to stop hepatitis C progression. So even in places where heart use is widespread, it's coming out as one of the leading causes of death. Fortunately, you can do something about it. You can prevent it. You can prevent it from occurring, and you can actually cure it once it occurs. You can eradicate hepatitis C from an individual, and therefore, if you had the resources, you could actually eradicate it from the world. And those are my comments this morning.
Thank you, Thomas. As you know, this is the last day of the conference, and I have the pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Bridget Smith, who is the AIDS 2010 local chair. Bridget is a president of the Australian AIDS Society and heads the HIV department and outpatient clinic of the Otto Wagner Hospital in Vienna. Her primary research interests include HIV and pregnancy and the care for HIV-positive pregnant women and infant prophylaxis, as well as post-exposure prophylaxis. She pioneered the immediate initiation of antiretroviral post-exposure prophylaxis and propagated its implementation throughout Austria. Bridget, I want to take this opportunity to thank you and your co-chair, Julio Montana,
Thank you very much, Ellie. I just want to provide you with a few numbers regarding the conference, which is finishing today in a couple of hours. There were 19,300 participants, more than 1,200 media delegates, 848 scholarship recipients, 10,831 abstracts were submitted and 6,238 abstracts accepted, and in totally we had 248 sessions. And I just want to summarize the, I think, three most important points. of the conference, at least for me, most important conference. I think it was a very lively and energetic conference with much activism, reflecting the strong commitment of the delegates to reach the goal of universal access to treatment, care, prevention, and support, and to put human rights in the center of the scale-up. The participation of the South African Deputy President Motlanthe and Health Minister Motsoaledi was very important. They gave impassioned speeches, and it was clear that they are very, very strong committed to changing the course of the epidemic in their country. And if you think on the conference on Durban 10 years ago in South Africa, the situation was completely different, and therefore I think that was very, very important and a very good sign. And looking back to Vienna, maybe in 1 year or 2 years, we will also remember the Vienna Declaration, which was a strong commitment to drug addiction and focusing that addiction is an illness and has to be treated and not criminalized, and that it is very important to provide drug addicted patients with harm reduction strategies such as needle and syringe exchange programs and opioid substitution therapy. Last but not least, Michelle Sidibe spoke about the prevention revolution, and I think the results, the really exciting and thrilling results of the Caprese microbicide trial we heard here, it's part of this prevention revolution, and were really very important. Because it puts the women in charge to take care of themselves independently of their partners. And in many regions, in many communities, and in many families, this is one issue of utmost importance. So AIDS 2010 is ending with a new resolve to hold political leaders accountable too for the commitments they have made to universal access, and we keep on working on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bridget. Like all international conferences on AIDS, we usually organize them in partnership with civil society partners. On this occasion, I would like to introduce one of those. Unfortunately, Patricia Perez is not with us, but I have the honor to introduce to you Rachel Ong, who is a chair of the Global Network of People Living with HIV and helped to establish the Women's Working Group, Women's Asia Pacific Network of People Living with HIV.
Thank you, Ellie. I'm sure that was a bit of a mouthful. This particular International AIDS Conference has been an historical moment for AIDS activists, key affected populations, and people living with HIV, because human rights have been intrinsic in many, many of the conversations. For us, this conference has had an enormous impact, as we have been able to address the social, political, jurisprudential nightmare that had been created over the years. These are deeply rooted in uninformed discriminations and prejudices experienced and faced by those most vulnerable and marginalized. Whilst we look forward to Washington 2012, we are also fully aware that there are certain limitations on visa applications and entry restrictions that might make the conference less credible by excluding key affected populations. And we hope that the IES will work hard to ensure that the conference can be truly inclusive. At the same time, this is a year that countries had pledged and committed to universal access for prevention, treatment, care, and support. But realistically, where are we? Donors and implementers have failed to adequately address issues of long-term HIV treatment funding, affordable access to second and third-line treatments, stockouts, TB and hepatitis co-infection, equitable access for harm reduction services, amongst many others. So 30 years on in this response, we finally have a chance to collectively address the changes necessary to reverse the negative impacts of unsound structural approaches in the response to testing, prevention, treatment, care, and support for people living with HIV and key populations. And this is what positive health, dignity, and prevention is all about. It is about supporting people living with HIV and affected communities to lead in the HIV response and to ensure that policies and programs are grounded in our realities. These programs will not be in place if donor countries do not honor their commitments, especially in the year of the third voluntary replenishment for the Global Fund. These commitments cannot and must not be linked to moralistic policies that jeopardize the rights of sex workers, drug users, men who have sex with men, transgender people, migrant workers, and people living with HIV. We need to match dollars to cents, and by cents, I mean S-E-N-S-E, so that we can finally and equally match needs to rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. At today's closing session, of course, the International AIDS Conference Globe will be passed off from Vienna to Washington, D.C. And I look forward myself to work with Dr. Diane Havil, who will serve as the AIDS 2012 local chair. Diane is the chief of HIV/AIDS division and principal investigator of the Adult AIDS Clinical Trials Group at the University of California in San Francisco. She has worked with the WHO since 2001 as a consultant in HIV/AIDS antiretroviral therapy, and most recently as part of the core committee for ART guidelines for research-limited setting. Diane.
Thank you, Ellie. First of all, I'd like to say that the Vienna meeting has really been a defining moment in the AIDS epidemic, which has really affirmed the commitment and the aspirations of the AIDS community. And as we move to Washington, D.C. in 2012, we will carry forward the priorities of universal access, the prevention revolution as outlined by Michelle Sidibe, and human rights. These commitments are going to be bolstered by groundbreaking science. And what we need to see and what we will see in Washington, D.C., that there will be evidence that the call to action and the things that we've heard in these plenaries that we need to do in vulnerable populations have been put into action, and not only globally, but locally in our country and in Washington, D.C. You know, there's no other field, I think, that brings together the scientific, community, political leaders like the International AIDS Conference. And I can tell you, I went to kind of the spectrum of sessions here, all the way ranging from the electrifying CAPRISA session to a session I went where law enforcement officials were wanting to know and discussing how can we do harm reduction. That's really an incredible gathering of people. So Washington, D.C., we hope also will be a historic event. It's going to propel our understanding and the mitigation and working towards conquering this epidemic. So what I'd say to you, please don't miss it. Be there July 22nd through 27th in 2012.
Thank you, Diane, and I'm sure they'll be there. Now the session is open for questions. We have two microphones in the front. And also we have mobile microphones. Please go to the microphone, state who you are and which organization you are representing. And we'll start with you.
Thank you. Ralf Leonhardt.
Ralf Leonhardt, ежедневная газета Tageszeitung, Berlin. Учитывая то, что эта конференция имела региональный фокус на Восточной Европе и Центральной Азии, несмотря на это, эти страны были мало представлены. Можете ли вы сказать в последний день, что конференция увенчалась успехом? Есть ли какой-то прогресс в деле защиты прав человека и прогресс в области сокращения вреда в этих странах? Или же все эти обсуждения остаются лишь в этих стенах и не доходят до лиц, принимающих политические решения? Я думаю, что конференция – это начало обсуждения, начало акцента на Восточную Европу, Центральную Азию и существующие там проблемы. Вы совершенно правы. Было лишь немного политиков из этого региона, которые участвовали.
In this conference, but
As I mentioned already, that the discussion starts with this conference, and the talks and the focusing on these issues doesn't end with the conference today, and it's a kind of development.
В Восточной Европе, на Азии, на этой конференции,
Eastern Europe and Central Asia,
на этой конференции только обозначили свои проблемы, которые есть в этих странах. И на самом деле здесь
in those countries have been only noted, mostly the NGOs are represented at this conference. In Eastern Europe and Central Asia, there is no strategic understanding of the consequences of the epidemics there. As of today, only the civil society at this conference and otherwise is crying that our countries are dying. In Ukraine, we have today 360,000 HIV-positive persons. After 2015, there will be 800,000, and there is no financing that would cover the treatment. So if the leaders of our countries this year or next year, unless they take maximum efforts to stop the epidemics, the set forecast is that we will have to teach our children how to live in the conditions of pandemia.
Antonio Sanchez from with EFE, the Spanish news agency. I have a question for Mr. Novak. Sir, you mentioned the lack of political will from the side of government to address the problem of drugs, HIV in prison, for instance. But what about the position of the United Nations itself? Because even within the United Nations system, there are some contradictory approaches. For instance, the position of the International Narcotic Control Board is quite clear against harm reduction, and even in the United Nations Office for Drug and Crime, the position is also not so clear. And the second question is, the new director of the UN, DCUC, is a Russian diplomat. Do you think that it could be a chance to help to the position of the Russian authorities, or on the contrary, it could be a setback in the position of the United Nations Office for Drug and Crime? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I am fortunately not a UN official. I am an independent expert appointed by the highest political body of the United Nations dealing with human rights. And I therefore agree with you and can say also that I agree with you and I agree also with the Vienna Declaration that the United Nations policy on drug control, which was very much influenced also by the so-called war on drugs, in my opinion, needs to be reconciled with a human rights-based approach. In the field of HIV/AIDS, I should say that there is an excellent cooperation between the Vienna-based UNODC and the Geneva-based WHO and UNAIDS. So there's a common approach in how to prevent and fight HIV/AIDS. But in relation to the drug policy, there are major differences, and we still need to bridge the gap between Geneva, in other words, the human rights-based approach, and Vienna. But I also see certain positive developments. That there are certain countries in all regions, whether it's in Latin America, take Bolivia, for instance, whether it's in Europe, take Switzerland and other countries, and even to some extent in the Asian region, to adopt a more proactive and human rights-based approach. So what we have heard, the reaction to drug use should not be criminalization, but assistance, treatment, I think there might be a beginning of a change that the so-called war on drugs was counterproductive and led to the one of the reasons for the overcrowding of the prisons in the United States of America, for instance, but in many other countries of the world, is the criminalization of drug users. As far as your second question is concerned, I think we should, every person who is newly appointed, give the benefit of the doubt in any case, and I could also see it as a positive sign. Exactly what Ralph Leonhardt said, was there enough attention by the Eastern European region, and in particular the Russian Federation, to the problem here at the Vienna World AIDS Conference? And perhaps it's a good sign to have a high-level Russian diplomat leading UNODC and being informed, and there are many people working in UNODC who actually have a very, very well-developed understanding of how to best not only fight HIV/AIDS, but also address the drug problem. It's not the question of the Secretariat. It is the question very much of the states that are governing the respective intergovernmental bodies. And perhaps that might raise awareness in the Russian Federation and other countries of Eastern Europe that we have to take the evidence-based interventions more seriously and adopt a human rights-based approach. Thank you.
Our last question.
Yes, next AIDS conference is going to... Oh, sorry, I'm Flavio from Brazil, Street Kiss newspaper, Rio de Janeiro. Next conference will be in Washington, D.C., USA, which is a country with serious restrictions on travel to sex workers and drug users. Are you all concerned with that, or is IAS concerned with that? Are there any strategies being planned to address this issue?
I think, as you know, one of the reasons why we were able to have the conference in Washington, D.C. was the lifting of the travel bans. But you're pointing out, and the community is appropriately raising some of the challenges, both in the implementations of the law has been changed and the scope of the law that exists. The philosophy of the conference, of our community, is to be inclusive and to allow and embrace and welcome participation of everyone in the conference. So we are committed to working through all the channels we can over the next 2 years to make that happen.
Maybe to add on that, we're already actually working on it. Those are some of, we've had our first conference coordinating committee, and that issue came up, and we've already set up mechanisms to address it. We have 2 years to do that, and we are working on that, I promise you. This lady wants to push us in another extra question. Go ahead.
Ms. Avon, I am the press secretary from Italy, Italian League for Fighting AIDS. And I agree, we will have maybe in the future somebody from East Europe, Central Asia, but I have to note that Italy is not here, not to speak, not to listen to. And I think that Mr. Novak knows very well the situation of Italian prisons. We have a lot of troubles about overcrowding and pre-trial detention, and we have no condoms, no needle exchange. We have a great prevalence. And so Italy is not East Europe, it's West Europe, and it's not here. And so I would like to hear a word from you about that, from Mr. Novak and Ms. Schmidt. Thanks.
I just can confirm what you said, but I don't know why Italy is not here at the conference. I think that is something I pass on to Brigitte Schmidt.
I don't know why either, I'm sorry. But in general, no country is excluded. And of course, it's said one of the focuses is Eastern Europe and Central Asia. But each country is in focus, actually. So we won't exclude any country.
Okay.
My name is Kirsten Madsen. I come from the Danish AIDS Foundation. David Thomas, is there any signs that the price will be lowered for the treatment of hepatitis C? Any activism around it? Because it sounded very good, but with the prices you listed, it also sounds very difficult.
The new drugs are not approved. I've never seen a new drug come out that was less expensive than the preceding drugs, especially when it's more effective. So I think that's a very important issue.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we have to end it here. And I want to thank you from the media. You are important to us because you are the one who carried these messages across the globe. And I also want to thank the speakers for their contributions. I want to remind you that around 13 to 15, there will be the repertoire session followed by the closing session. You are all welcome in session room 1. Thank you.